Hi, everyone. This is Tom Salemi, Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. We have a super extra long special episode for you today. We broke the 60-minute mark and then some, but it's all great stuff. It's all great, great material. It's all great med tech talk. So happy to be bringing you these conversations. This entire podcast is sponsored by our great friends at Resonetics, and we'll have a message from Resonetics three times throughout the podcast. We'll first be speaking with Jason Feipel of Medtronic. He is the Senior Product Development Director of Brain Modulation, or Brain Modulation at Medtronic. Chris Newmarker and I had the chance to talk to him about Medtronic's Percept RC DBS system. This was, full disclosure, this conversation took place back in March. So it was shortly after Medtronic received positive news about Percept. Unfortunately, we had to hold on to this interview because we got wrapped up in all of our Device Talks Boston stuff. Similarly, our keynote guest today, Gary Justack, who is president and general manager of Foot and Ankle at Innovus. I talked with Gary back in March as well. So we've been holding on to these hot little numbers to get them into your hands. But both are really great interviews, bringing, I think, some great insight into a couple of really interesting spaces. I mean, obviously, neuro is surging, and we'll learn why Medtronic is excited about Percept RC, and I gained a new understanding and appreciation for foot and ankle. Gary's got a great story, including a great story about how he came into orthopedic sales, and we'll talk about that. He'll have some advice for newcomers, and we'll get into how Innovus is really working to compete in this space. So once again, the entire episode is sponsored by Resonetics, and as I'll mention a little later in the podcast, we've got a Device Talks Tuesday coming up with Resonetics. But I wanted to first tell you that this Tuesday coming up, Tuesday, June 4th, we've got a conversation centered around biocompatibility, which is always a hot topic, and this webinar is drawing particularly well, not surprising. So the topic is, or the title is, biocompatibility testing, what you need to know, and it's brought to you by our friends at Nelson Labs. So please make sure you join us for this Device Talks Tuesdays coming up, and take a look at the whole list of Device Talks Tuesdays episodes we have coming your way. We have one nearly every week, and they're all great, and they're all free, and they're all available to watch live or on demand. Either way, you can ask questions of our great sponsors and learn so much. So make sure you go to devicetalks.com to find out about that. And that's it. I'm working on Device Talks West, working on a few other projects. I'll give you more details about that later on. Let's get this podcast started. And thanks again to Resonetics for sponsoring. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Newmarker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well.
You brought some reinforcements in our Boston versus Minnesota battle. You had to bring in a ringer from Medtronic, didn't you?
Yeah. You're outnumbered today, Tom. You're outnumbered.
We've got Jason Feipel. So Jason is with Medtronic's neuromodulation business. Jason, welcome to the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a big fan of the podcast. I've listened to you guys forever and glad to be on Chris's side on Team Minnesota today.
Woo, Minnesota. But anyway, this is really exciting to have Jason on here. Just 2 months ago, I wrote about Medtronic winning FDA approval of its Percept RC Deep Brain Stimulation System, their next-gen DBS device that the company described as game-changing. And Jason worked on this device, so it's exciting to have you here, Jason, to talk about it. About I wanted to start out actually like Jason, I was looking at your background, and you have a really interesting background. You're in the Marine Signal Corps in East Asia.
Exactly. Yeah, I have an interesting path to med tech. And I started my career in the Marine Corps as a signals intelligence officer. I spent most of my time in Asia, and really technically heavy job, but rewarding and satisfying. And so when I was ending my service in the Marines, I had the opportunity to work with a placement firm that specializes in kind of putting military officers into companies and into roles in companies to start a new career. And I connected with Medtronic. And for me, going from the Marine Corps core values of honor, courage, commitment, and transforming to, alleviating pain, restoring health, and extending life was a natural fit.
We always do love to learn about paths of med tech. So when you were, why did you join the Marine Corps, first of all? Was that were you a military family, or what drove you to the military?
I did not grow up in a military family, other than my grandfathers had served kind of in the World War II era. But I grew up in Iowa, small town, and just had a lot of really good role models, and somebody who had come before me in my high school. I was an athlete. I played football. I was attending the Air Force Academy. And so I got exposed to the service academies and applied to the Naval Academy. I was interested, like many young Naval Academy midshipmen, in becoming Maverick and Top Gun or something like that.
Just thinking that, yeah.
And for me, I got to spend lots of time while I was at the Naval Academy in different roles in the military. And what always resonated was just, kind of the opportunity to lead Marines. And so I became inspired by many of the mentors and the Marines that I encountered during my time at the Naval Academy. And so that's why I ultimately chose to go Marine ground. And then where signals intelligence was a very technical, heavy, job in the military. And so I was excited to kind of pair that leadership with the technology and the technical side. And that's what I spent my time doing in the military.
Well, thank you for doing that. I think it must've awesome. Been, was it, how formative was it an experience? I've got young boys, teenage boys. What did that time do for you?
I don't think you can understate how formative it was. I mean, just the basic, I sometimes tell my colleagues here that I think other than my first year and a half at Medtronic, I've had some leadership responsibility for another human ever since I was 19 years old. And so just the opportunity to learn at a young age and try things and make mistakes and, get exposed to incredible leaders who have done, amazing feats in challenging circumstances and kind of learn from them. It's really not replaceable. And for me, I draw upon things that I learned throughout my service in the military every single day in my role.
And these days you're working on, these pacemaker-like deep brain stimulation devices that treat Parkinson's and other conditions. The Percept RC that's won the FDA approval. I mean, I saw the Medtronic, it described it as like the first sensing-able rechargeable device. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, why is that important in DBS?
Yeah, we're really proud of Percept RC because it really completes a journey that we've been on for over the past 15 years or so. So for those of your listeners who maybe aren't familiar with DBS, deep brain stimulation is a treatment for patients with Parkinson's disease. We also can treat epilepsy, a dystonia, and obsessive compulsive disorder. And it's implanting a small electrode in the brain and attaching it to a pacemaker device, like what you mentioned before. We were the originator of the therapy and going all the way back to 1987. And we were there for the first implants of deep brain stimulation. And it's a really good therapy for patients who have Parkinson's disease. And Parkinson's disease is a degenerative neurological condition. There's over 11 million people worldwide. It's one of the fastest growing neurological conditions. And at some point, there's no cure. So at some point, the medication stops working as effectively. And DBS may be a good treatment option for those patients. And we know it's a great therapy. Patients, who have the tremor, typically most personified kind of in the arm or the hand where they're not able to rest. And DBS for Medtronic or for someone in the medical device industry, sometimes it's hard to see the results of your work. If you maybe work on a stent or you work on even a heart failure device, those things are obviously life-saving devices and transformative for our patients, but sometimes it's hard to actually see visually the results. And for DBS is one of those examples. And I'd encourage your listeners to go on YouTube or look up videos, Medtronic has some, and there's, you know, our researchers and others are out there, of where that patient who can't maybe hold a cup of coffee or a cup of water, which can be debilitating if you, you know, if you're suffering from those symptoms and you can't go out to eat with your friends, you might not, you know, be able to go to your you know, kids' sporting events or things like that. And when that device gets switched on, it's just amazing. And sort of the treatment power of the stimulation, it's really humbling, and that motivates me, and it motivates our whole team every day to try to continue to move this therapy forward.
And I've seen some of those videos, and when the technology is working, I mean, it's like flipping a switch. I mean, they have the tremor and then they don't, you know, and that's
exactly. And I think just to kind of go back to your original question and complete it, because that was sort of preamble, and it's for the past 30 years or so, the standard of care has been to, you know, obviously implant that lead in the right location. That's really important. But then with the stimulation, you're basically observing the patient, and you're trying to see, are symptoms getting better? Are there any side effects? And it's happening live, and it takes time, and can be an arduous process, both for the patient who may be off their medications and for the clinician. It can take time. And we know that with the state of healthcare today, clinicians are extremely overburdened. They're very busy. And so to get back to your question around Percept RC, that journey that we went on about 15 years ago was to change the standard of care in DBS, which is, how can we sense, or how can we get an insight into that patient's brain state? And how could we use the brain sense, is what we call them, but the brain signals, to try to change how DBS care is delivered? And so through partnerships with the National Institutes of Health Brain Initiative and leading research institutions all around the world, over the past 15 years, we've been developing our brain sense technology, which can listen to the signals of the brain. And so in 2020, we actually launched the first commercial device, the Percept primary cell, or a non-rechargeable version. And then in 2021, we launched a lead, which is specially designed for electrical isolation, because these signals are the signals that are being sensed by the device are 1 million times softer than the stimulation pulses that the device is delivering. And so that's like being in a crowded stadium, you know, when the Minnesota Vikings score a touchdown, and being able to sense all the way through that noise of the stadium to a conversation that's happening at, you know, normal voice levels like we're talking right now. And so now the Percept RC completes that portfolio. We have a non-rechargeable, we have a specially designed lead, and we have our rechargeable device.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's kind of like the whole portfolio. And how does this sensing technology work? I mean, I see the lead, I'm thinking of the lead delivering electrical pulses, but how does that sensing work?
The sensing it's passive, meaning we're actually blanking out in the device the stimulation pulse and listening to what are called local field potentials, which are essentially the signaling of groups of neurons in the brain. So we're listening to those signals, and we know that those signals correspond to symptoms. And so clinicians could use that data today using our both either Percept PC or Percept RC to help guide the patient's care, maybe stimulate in the right place on the lead, or adjust the level of stimulation to make sure that the patient's receiving the right dosage.
How does the sensing work? So this is something like they do the sensing when the the patient's at the clinic. Then
they can sense while the patient's at the clinic. We have certain features that are maybe a little bit more advanced features for the clinician to use while they're with the patient. But also the sensing can be enabled while that patient's at home. So we can get a window into their brain states and how the brain states fluctuate with their activities of daily living, maybe because our patients are taking medicines and getting stimulation. So we can see the impact, the effects of the medicines on the brain signals. We can see impacts of other activities, maybe eating or sleeping or other things. And so those signals, the clinician can enable the sensing, and then and that can go home with that patient, and then they can review the data at the patient's next visit.
Wow. How does the... so it's enabled while they're there. So the communication's not taking place when they're home, but the clinician can have that turned on so that the data is being recorded, you know, the entire time they're away. And then they come back and, I guess there'd be something like a reader then that reads it. Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. Cause so it's like place, the can's like probably underneath the collarbone or next to the collarbone. That's fascinating though, that I imagine that probably helps out a lot too, because I mean, to ask the patient to do things to collect the data is just like one extra, you know, step. While this is just basically like you can use the programmer to flip on the sensing function, collect the data, you know, get it down and examine it once they get back in for their checkup. And the lead, I mean, you're talking about this special lead that came out in recent years. I mean, tell me a little bit more about that. I mean, and you know, what is it? Oh, there it is. All right.
So the SenSight lead, and obviously it's named as a wordplay on BrainSense. It's a directional lead. So there's 8 contacts on the lead. The middle 2 contacts are split out at so in thirds. And so, but the real innovation in this lead is the electrical isolation. And kind of going back to your question about how does sensing work. These, as I mentioned before, these signals are very, very, very small. And there's a lot of noise in the body. You've got organs, you've got muscles, you've got tissue, you've got the external environment. And so the SenSight lead has specially designed electrical isolation to enable that very small sensing signal to get to the device and so that it can be used. And I should just say the innovation for us and why we're so proud of brain sensing is really around the electronics that are able to filter out all the noise, filter right down to that brain sense signal that then the clinician can use to adjust the therapy.
How small are these signals that you're trying to catch?
They're microvolt signals. Wow. So if you think about stimulation might be at volts, microvolts is a million times smaller.
So I suspect probably it's kind of neat. The sensing technology collects the information you learn from it that informs your algorithms more. And so this is kind of like it seems to me this is almost like a very cool cycle that like gets this technology better and better as time goes along and more people use it.
I think you hit on something really important and why I'm personally extremely excited about the journey we're on. And so I came into, I started my career, I worked in cardiac, I worked in spine, and I came to the neuromodulation division to work on brain devices specifically because there's so much undiscovered about the brain. You know, there's a lot of companies out there. There's amazing innovation happening in our industry. And we think we're right up there with all the other companies that are doing, you know, things in the brain space. And I think we're at this point now where we have this commercial system. We've got over 40,000 patients implanted with a sensing capable system. And the things that we're already discovering about how the brain adjusts to its environment and what kind of things are happening while that patient's at home are already informing kind of our next generation of devices. And so we have an investigation, we have a clinical trial ongoing that's been kind of well publicized within our industry that's completed. And we're really excited to bring the results and bring the next features to market. And that's studying an investigational adaptive algorithm, which auto adjust that patient's stimulation dose based on those brain sense signals. And so that's something is kind of a next generation. And then, as I mentioned before, we're actively collecting and gathering data and partnering with research institutions throughout the globe. And I think we're just at the beginning of the journey of what kind of innovation can be spurred by this brain sense technology. And so that's something that we're excited at Medtronic about. We've already got our scientists and our researchers digging in and trying to understand kind of how that's going to build into a roadmap for us of improvements to this platform. And one of the things that I didn't mention earlier is the platform is upgradable. So we have the opportunity once we learn and we come up and we develop with new algorithms, we have the ability to deploy those algorithms either to the software or into the device firmware itself.
Wow. I mean, how much computing power do you need in the can of that device to be able to do that?
I mean, you kind of have two options. You can put a bunch of computing power into it, and obviously that, you know, requires more battery. And so we do use we do have really well designed one of the expertises of Medtronic is our ability to design kind of low current draw circuits, and we've certainly drawn on that core competency to develop this device. So we know that even if the patients are sensing is turned on, it has a negligible impact on the overall battery longevity. So we don't need a lot of processing power because we've been able to make the device and the circuitry smart enough that it does all the key functions on the device that it needs to do. And then we get data off of the device in order to kind of dive deeper into it.
So it's just kind of interesting, like that you can get that down, and it kind of leads, you know, the fact that you can like have a lot of that computing going away from the device. I mean, that kind of like leads to kind of like one of the other major features of it was that, I mean, you're making it smaller. I mean, that was the other thing Medtronic was saying. This is the smallest that they've ever gone with that. I mean, how small is it compared to the previous generations?
Yeah, so it's 30% smaller than our previous generation. So this device is 13.77 cc's, but we're very excited about how thin it is. And we were able to leverage some technology at Medtronic and going all the way back to our Intellis spinal cord stimulation platform, where we had, you know, basically how we developed it was we started with different form factors and kind of four competing form factors that were all very different, and then started drawing concentric circles around what do patients prefer, what do surgeons prefer, what's most important. And so the curves of the device, the thickness of the device, the form factor is really optimized through that development experience and that learning so that it's comfortable for that patient. So we know that it's, you know, the thickness is really important. And we know that, you know, this is sitting just under the skin, you know, about 2 millimeters or so under the skin. And something that's nice and thin and kind of rounded, which is what the Percept RC is something that's going to be maximally comfortable for patients.
So it's a lot thinner now. And like just, you know, I mean, miniaturization has been such a big trend across our industry. I mean, like what kind of technological and design challenges did you have to kind of overcome to get it 30% smaller like that? And it sounds like do more.
Yeah. So for us, one of the biggest innovations in this device that we're bringing to market is the battery. And so with a rechargeable device, what allows us to make it smaller is we can have a smaller battery that's obviously recharged by that patient. So a non-rechargeable device is typically is bigger. But with a rechargeable device, we have a much smaller battery, which gives us more room to put all the circuitry that we need into the device housing.
Oh, that's fantastic. So it's really the battery, that getting that battery down in there. Okay. With what?
And for us, like the battery, again, this is a story of Medtronic innovation. You know, we have our battery manufacturing and design center of excellence here in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And so Percept RC uses a chemistry, which we call Overdrive, which is actually a proprietary, our iteration of is a proprietary chemistry that we use in our rechargeable devices, which, as I mentioned, all designed within Medtronic and manufactured here in Minnesota. And some of the features of that is, you know, your cell phone and most other batteries, including, you know, rechargeable cars, are lithium ion batteries. And so lithium ion is using graphite to store lithium ions, and the graphite gets tired over time as you're recharging, you're discharging, you're recharging. And so what we use is a technology called lithium titanate, which is something that doesn't get tired as it's recharging. And so that enables us to have confidence that our batteries at 15 years are going to maintain 99% of their original capacity, which means that you won't get that fade you get on your cell phone battery when you've had a cell phone for a couple of years and maybe it doesn't last a whole day anymore because it's just the lithium batteries ultimately wear out. And so that's one of the big innovations with this new chemistry. And it also just makes it easier to recharge much, much more quickly than the previous device, which could take, you know, 3 or 4 hours to recharge from empty to full. And this device takes an hour to recharge.
And how is the recharging done? You just place something up against it?
Yeah, so there's a recharger. Mm-hmm. It's a wireless recharger, real simple. And we have a drape that a patient can put the recharger in. And, you know, the device is typically in their chest. And so they can sit and watch TV or crochet or read a book while they're recharging. And typical patients under typical use conditions, you know, if they recharge, you know, 15 minutes a day, they'll be, you know, they'll never have to worry about their battery.
We'll take our first sponsor break. I'm happy to bring in our sponsor, Resonetics. Resonetics is a regular supporter of Device Talks. Very happy to have them as part of this podcast episode. Also happy to have them as the sponsor of a Device Talks Tuesdays episode that's coming up on June 25th. It's called Demystifying Nitinol Shape Setting: Prescriptive Tools for Achieving Target Performance. You can find out more information about that at devicetalks.com. But we're not here to talk about that Device Talks Tuesdays today. We're here to talk about Lightspeed. I am speaking with Andy Paganaw. He is Director of Strategic Projects at Resonetics and part of its Lightspeed program. Andy, introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about Lightspeed. Where's it located?
I'm Andy Paganaw. I'm the Director of Strategic Projects in Bethel, Connecticut. I was part of the acquisition of Memory Corporation late last year, and I'm on the Lightspeed team.
Andy, tell us a bit more about Lightspeed. We hear a lot about it, but where does it fit into Resonetics?
Lightspeed is the new product development group within Resonetics. We have dedicated resources that allow us to move really quickly. And we have really aggressive goals on quote turnaround time and prototype lead times. We're actually just setting up a new Lightspeed lab here in Bethel, Connecticut.
So that's cool. You're setting up a lab in Bethel, Connecticut. Nice New England place, not too far from us up here in Boston. Tell us, Andy, what is the specialty going to be of that lab in Bethel, Connecticut?
So coming from the legacy memory corporations from the acquisition, we're really focused on night and all materials and night and all medical devices. We will do everything from laser cutting, shape setting, through to conventional machining and surface finishing of night and all components. But our specific focus in Bethel is really going to be on orthopedic implants, surgical tools, and things like that.
All right. Well, once again, Resonetics is a huge player in Nightingale, and I hope you'll join us at the Device Talks Tuesday that's coming up on June 25th. I'll visit again with Andy Paganaw a little later in the podcast. But if you want to find out more about Resonetics right now, go to its website, resonetics.com. Do patients use battery at different paces? I mean, does someone have... require more intervention than someone else, and their battery may require more recharging?
Absolutely. There's a wide variability for the different conditions that CBS is indicated for. Mm-hmm. So a patient who's a Parkinson's disease patient, maybe early in their DBS tenure, might use significantly less battery. And again, I use the word might because all patients are different. It sure depends. But there are certain conditions like dystonia, for example, or some epilepsy patients that their clinicians choose to run at a much higher setting. And so those patients would deplete their battery faster and so may need to recharge sooner, or if they have a non-rechargeable device, get a new battery replaced every couple of years.
How does the patient know the battery needs to be recharged?
Yeah, so we have a Samsung handset. So it's a modified Samsung cell phone that has an app on it, and that gives them, they can set a notification to recharge, but it gives them the battery status. And then while they're recharging, they can see where their battery's at. So maybe they're not going to sit and do a full recharge, but they know kind of in increments of 10% what their battery status is.
Wow, that's fantastic. And because you have this capability now, so with the older, the previous generation devices that were non-rechargeable, how long did you have to wait before this had to get swapped out? I mean,
so the previous devices lasted 15 years. This device is also labeled for 15 years. And as I mentioned before, it takes advantage of the long-lasting battery technology so that we're confident that they're going to have the same experience at, 15 years as they do in year one.
And I thought it was interesting too that, because of the this ability to do the software upgrades, so it really sounds like you made this as a device that could be a standard for a long period of time. Like the innovation then, takes place on the software, in those years going forward, because you can update. Like somebody isn't sitting there saying like, gosh, I got this device 5 years ago and I don't have the latest, what did you think of when you were thinking like, we need this to be like, people need to still feel like this is the best technology, like a decade from now.
Absolutely. So what I'm always telling our teams is about designing for that patient's journey. And we know our patients are going to live with Parkinson's disease for the rest of their life. There is no cure, unfortunately. We're obviously excited and hopeful that there will be a cure someday. And so when they make the decision to choose DBS, they're, we're there for their entire journey for the rest of their life. Yeah. And so we want to make that experiences, positive and effective for them as we possibly can. And so, we've been there. We've treated over 180,000 patients We're very close to our patients, and our teams in the field are interacting with patients all the time and every day, whether they're getting implanted that day or they're on their third DBS implant. And so we know that that these patients are our patients for life. And so when we're developing our technologies, we're thinking about not only the new patients that are going to need the technology in the future, but also those existing patients, and how can we make sure that we're kind of future proofing their device for them, so that they have the confidence that as the scientific community and the researchers and the technologists are developing new ways to treat their disease state, that they, if we're able to upload it to their device, that they're going to be able to get the benefits from that, even if they, if they choose Medtronic.
I'd like to go back a little bit to the sensing function. How does that, how does that speed up the implanting process? Because it sounds like that's like getting that sped up could increase adoption, because this isn't something that a clinician is spending a large chunk of their day trying to get done.
Yeah. So during the implant procedure, so neurosurgeons implanting, the sensing feature is typically not going to be used extensively in that procedure. But really where it is a game changer is for the neurologist or movement disorder specialist who's programming that patient's device. And so, it can take time to optimize a patient. All patients are different. They can be very difficult and challenging, to balance controlling the symptoms and mitigating the side effects. And so our goal with sensing is to make the process of programming the patient and getting them optimized to their initial setting so that they can go back to living their daily life. And BrainSense is one tool that enables that by giving a window into what's going on in that patient's brain at that time in response to maybe a certain level of stimulation, or activity in the office. So they were just trying to give more tools out instead of relying on their own eyes and kind of what they're seeing or hearing from the patients. They have another tool that's going to hopefully get them to that optimal setting for that patient faster.
I think we covered a little bit already, like kind of what's next. I mean, you're talking about, working kind of on this next gen device that adjusts itself while the therapies, because it sounds like right now, like you go in, the neurologist, looks at the data, sees how it goes and makes adjustments. But kind of like, it sounds like one of the really next big things that you're, moving through clinical studies is like actually having the technology adjust itself.
We know that one of the problems is that that patient is experiencing the effects of medication, maybe other effects of sleep or exercise or other things. They're living their life. And so the standard of care today is to set their stimulation at a certain level. We do give them the opportunity, if clinicians so choose, to give, maybe turn it up or turn it down within a clinician set limits. But that requires that patient to, interact with their device, open up their programmer. And really our goal is to free our patients from their disease states. And so we're really excited about, closed loop technologies and the benefits of both brain sensing, but all the other accumulated data sets around DBS that we can use to help better personalize the therapy for the patient so that they don't have to think about it and they don't have to interact with their device, and that their symptoms are controlled so that they can live their daily life.
Like how much, I'm interested to find out, how much do you think AI, all the advancements we're seeing in AI, like generative AI, it's got everybody talking about it now. How do you see that enabling, where you'd like to see DBS going?
I am extremely excited about the opportunities of using tools and technologies like artificial intelligence. In fact, we're using, machine learning and developing the algorithms and some of the filtering techniques and things like that on the existing device. So we've been benefiting from that technology already. But as we think about, the care continuum for a patient from first diagnosis to their medicines to a procedure where they maybe get a device like DBS implanted, to BrainSense, which can follow that patient throughout their life, and then maybe other inputs from apps or wearables or other technologies. I think there's a huge opportunity for us in DBS to continue to improve the therapy by taking advantage of some of those new technologies. And we're already starting to experiment with some things and really excited at the potential. And I'm certainly excited about where this field can go here over the next few years.
Yeah, what do things look like? I mean, there's we don't want to get into naming names, but the neuro field is getting a lot of attention from, let's say, less traditional med tech players. who also build cars and spaceships. Yeah. How does that, how is that, what kind of energy is that injected into the industry? So broad question there, and then more specific question there. What do you see happening for your line of products in the future? What, without giving away trade secrets, what excites you about where this is headed?
Yeah, we're really encouraged by the continued investment in not only neuromodulation, but kind of the brain and the neuroscience space more broadly. We're plugged into a lot of the same, you know, trade associations or research institutions that some of the other, you know, names that folks have heard before is, but really we're focused on, you know, Parkinson's disease is is the fastest growing neurological condition. And we know that, you know, of the patients who are eligible for deep brain stimulation therapy, which is a very effective therapy in the U.S., somewhere around, you know, 10 to 15% of those patients are actually getting the therapy. And so we're focused on that patient population that is really underserved by this therapy. We know it's a great therapy, and we're trying to improve the therapy for those patients and for the clinicians that are managing those patients so that we can, you know, make it a more universal therapy so that we can help those patients kind of get back to attending their kids' sporting events or, you know, family events or dinner or lunch with their friends.
Traditionally, what has kept the other 85% away?
I think awareness is a big is a big obstacle. Movement disorder specialists are incredibly skilled and very valuable clinicians within a hospital system, but not every area, you know, even in the United States, let alone in, you know, less developed countries, they don't, maybe don't. So the movement disorder specialist community is well aware of deep brain stimulation. The neurosurgery community is well aware, but, you know, primary care physicians may be caring for a Parkinson's patient or general neurologists, and they might not be aware. And so by conducting discussions like this, and we're always trying to get out there and have our folks out to Parkinson's groups, but we know it's a therapy that more patients could benefit from, and we're excited to be able to help serve those patients in the future.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, it definitely sounds like it's something that, you know, we could access like in Boston or Minneapolis, but, you know, I definitely like wonder right now, like back in the old factory town I grew up in Ohio, like would that be available? Would that be available for my relatives there? So it sounds like a big part of it is making this, you know, as easy as possible to get basically get the technology into people.
Exactly. I mean, there's hundreds of implanting centers in the United States. I mean, every region, every state has implanting centers, but it's not something that's maybe as common at a community hospital in a smaller community if they don't have a neurosurgeon, especially not one that's trained to implant DBS. So we're obviously dedicated to supporting fellows and building capacity of surgeons, and we have a long history of doing that over the past few decades. And so with our newer technologies, our goal is to try to continue to make that therapy more approachable, easier to use, less requiring specialized, you know, training to use it, and hope, you know, make it more accessible so that we can treat more patients.
Great, great stuff. Congratulations on the progress. And thanks for joining us on the podcast, Jason.
Yeah,
it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me, and have a great rest of your week.
Before we continue with this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast, I'd like to bring back our sponsor, Resonetics. Once again, I'm speaking with Andy Paganaugh. He's Director of Strategic Projects at Lightspeed, the group within Resonetics. Andy, a little earlier in the podcast, we talked about your new space in Bethel, Connecticut. You're going to be focusing on orthopedics. Can you give us a little more detail? What sort of orthopedic applications will you be working on?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we work on tons of different applications. A lot of them are focused on extremities. So looking at bone staples, compression plates, hammer toe implants for foot and ankle, K-wires, surgical drills. And we also do a lot of things like suture anchor inserters and suture passing wires. You know, the suture passer is actually one of the first FDA cleared nitinol implant devices. So it's been around for a while in Bethel, Connecticut here. We've been manufacturing those since the beginning. And these applications are rapidly expanding to other applications, for example, spine. You know, and our customers are really seeking to utilize the unique functional properties of the nitinol material that we work with.
So Andy, Resonetics has a lot of experience in Nitinol, and we'll talk about that again a little later on Device Talks Tuesdays later in June. Tell me, how does Resonetics and Lightspeed work with companies using Nitinol to get products to market faster and to ensure the quality is where it needs to be?
Definitely expertise and experience. So you hit that nail on the head there. You know, we've been making bone staples, for example, for over 10 years. Suture passers and drills, we've been making for over 15 years. So we really have a good understanding of, you know, the process flows. We have optimized processes for all these different types of devices. We also have a fully equipped test lab. So for helping with some regulatory submissions, do corrosion testing, mechanical testing, and we have the ability to measure phase transformations.
And Andy, we're talking about the new plant in Bethel, but where else does Resonetics do work with Nitinol? And tell us about some of the other services.
In upstate New York, we have our Resonetics Smart Materials site, which is one of the first commercial melters of Nitinol. So we actually have the added advantage as well, looking all the way back to the starting material and what net shape, if it is a unique net shape, unique properties that we need to start with, we have that advantage as well.
Excellent. Well, we'll begin the conversation with Gary Justack. Once again, Gary is the president and general manager of Innovus's foot and ankle business. We'll talk about how Innovus is bulking up and preparing for the battle that's being waged in foot and ankle. It's actually quite an active space. Innovus has a very broad portfolio, and Nitinol is part of it. And we'll get into that with Gary a little bit later. If you want to find out more about Resonetics, go to Resonetics' website, resonetics.com. That's Resonetics.com. That's Resonetics' website. We'll hear a little more from Andy a little bit later in the podcast. Now let's begin the interview I did with Gary Justack. Again, he's president and general manager of Innovus's foot and ankle business. Well, Gary Justack, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
We were just sharing sports stories. You're a Chicago fan. I'm a Boston fan. And we unfortunately have to talk about MedTech because I think we were having a pretty good time talking about the Cubs and the Sox. But let's talk about your career path. We always like to start these interviews learning how folks found their way into the MedTech industry. And you started off in sales and wine and spirits at National Wine and Spirits. And I see that a lot. And I thought it was just a coincidence. Then I talked to people. I'm like, no, people have told me that that's a really great sort of entry-level sales position to get into MedTech. So how did you make the leap from where you were into the medtech industry? And you can talk about
I appreciate
job.
The question. Actually, my path to medtech started when I was in college. I went to Indiana and, you know, DePew, Synthes, or it wasn't Synthes at the time, it was J&J. They came down for a recruiting visit and I applied for a market research co-op position at DePew. And I knew nothing about medtech at the time. I just obviously knew growing up in Indiana that Warsaw was the orthopedic capital of the universe. It is as advertised. You can't go out to dinner and talk about work because the table next to you probably has six people that works at your company. And so I went up there in 2002. I did a winter co-op, which winter in Warsaw is not fun. So we spent a lot of time working, but I got to know orthopedics. I actually was on the market research team. I was a finance major. And they said, hey, why don't you go help with sales training? And I walked over there. And I saw, you know, Mercedes, BMW. And I was like, what is this? And they said, well, this is medical device sales. And I learned everything I knew about orthopedics at the time. And then, you know, I said, I wanted to get into it. And they said, you got to get sales experience, right? So you alluded to National Wine and Spirits, which was E&J Gallo. So E&J Gallo, I actually got a job with Gallo when I graduated from college. Spent 3 years in their management development program, got sales experience. They do run one of the best sales training programs in the country.
Interesting.
And they teach you just the bread and butter sales process, you know, how to forecast and how to cold call and how to do all those things. And so I did that for 3 years. And then shortly after Stryker made the Howmedica Osionics acquisition, they started to create a dedicated team for trauma. And it sounds familiar because we're going to talk about foot and ankle and that pathway. But They took trauma away from Recon and I was the second rep in Chicago at the time. So I spent 7 years doing trauma sales for Stryker. And then when Stryker acquired MMI and they decided to create a dedicated foot and ankle team, I got into the management side of Foot and Ankle, and you know, was at Stryker for the better part of 10 years.
Let's jump to Stryker for a moment, because I sometimes get emails from folks who are interested in sales and they want to find a path, and I may someday send someone to you now that you're part of the podcast mafia. Because people ask me, how do I make the jump into MedTech? You already had that experience at DePuy, which I'm sure helped a bit. But how did that transition go? Was it a natural fit? Was there something you felt like you needed to do to really distinguish yourself to Stryker and to get that job? What was that process like?
Yeah, the interview process is a little lengthy. I think in total, it was like 6 months.
Wow.
And certainly, okay. Yeah, I had 3 years of sales experience. But at the time, like, you know, they want people with med tech experience, considering the clinical and technical side of it. And so, you know, one, I think it was my persistence. Obviously, Stryker's got a pedigree of people that they look for in terms of personality type. My biggest recommendation is get to know yourself. You know, things like StrengthFinders is a really good test for you to understand kind of what makes you tick. It's also a fun experiment to do with your wife to see, you know, what makes her tick and where you guys don't necessarily agree. You know, I was just persistent. And when I got the opportunity to get an interview, I had success at Gallo. And so I had examples of that success. I talked about how I developed the territory, what I did to grow business, you know, what I did to foster relationships. And ultimately, you know, it's still a relationship business. You know, you can have the best technology in the world. And I know we'll get into that, but certainly the relationship side matters. And here's what I tell our sales training team. When you get the opportunity, being a great sales rep in MedTech isn't hard, but so few people are really good at it because they lose focus on everybody else in the process, right? So you focus so much on the surgeon. It's not necessarily the surgeon. It's about everybody at every level of that hospital that you go to, from supply chain to materials management to the nursing staff. Everything you can do to make their lives easier certainly will make you better prepared to be a really, really good partner and have a successful career in device.
Interesting. Okay, cool. No, thank you for that. You joined Trauma Sales in 2006. You were talking about that a bit. Then you moved over to Foot and Ankle 2013. Is that right?
With Stryker. So it was right after they bought MMI and Stryker. And honestly, that's kind of where a little bit of the passion for how we're creating this business came from. You know, it was this recipe that you had this multi-billion dollar company that made an investment and was willing to incubate a business unit to essentially go build it the way that it needed to be built at the time. And it was difficult because at that time you're taking, I came from trauma and I stepped over to the other side of the aisle and I ended up taking, you know, business away from the guys that I was selling with because they weren't focusing on the business. And so considering the, you know, the 13,000 surgical customers that exist in Foot and Ankle between podiatry and fellowship trained MDs, you know, creating dedication in the space is a critical thing in order to be able to grow the segment. And it was interesting. We, you know, those 3 to 4 years, you were able to kind of do it the way you know you needed to do it and aggressively. And Stryker had tremendous growth in the foot and ankle space during that time. I ended up leaving, you know, because there were some leaders at Stryker that came over to DJO at the time. Mike Mogul being one of them. He was the former group president over the orthopedic division. Sharon Brown, who ran the trauma division. So certainly built those relationships during my time in performance at Stryker. And what DJO offered was something unique. You know, there's no company really in the orthopedic space that could offer this continuum of care from stem to stern for a patient. And it was that thought process in terms of how healthcare was evolving that I eventually decided to leave Stryker and come to DJO. And I'm almost, I looked at this today because I was like, I got to get my dates right. But I've almost been at Innovis as long as I was at Stryker.
Oh, wow. And yeah, it's amazing.
So I've been to 2 places in my career in orthopedics. And a lot of what, you know, I know you talked to Matt a while ago, but a lot of what we're building is, you know, it is that startup mentality incubated by a larger company that's willing to make the investment in process improvement, but also in bolt-on acquisitions to help you go build something different in the space. I mean, there are a lot of similarities, you know, in terms of call points and areas of focus. I think the main difference that was attractive to me at the time, right, and we certainly have grown to now be over $2 billion in terms of revenue on the Innovis side, was you had the opportunity to come and be a part of building something. DJO existed for, you know, it's been around for 44 years. But what they were doing is they were trying to expand into other aspects of orthopedics, right? Very heavy, obviously, in the preventative and rehab side, the bracing side, and the team sports side. But they had this opportunity to kind of break into the surgical recon or the implant side. And so for me, it was interesting to learn the other side of the business because I spent most of my time in implants at Stryker. Stryker obviously has multiple divisions, but the one thing that I think we pride ourselves at Innovis is you still have that small company feel. And I think that's important when you talk about nimbleness, do you want to be the large cruise liner that has to rotate in the ocean, or do you want to be the speedboat? And certainly what we've been able to do is have this ability to be a little bit more aggressive in terms of the structure, aggressive in terms of acquisition strategy, and really trying to build what already is one of the next great orthopedic device companies out there. And so I think it's similar. I think it's just at different points. You know, you look at the early run of Stryker, and certainly they had something like 20 years of 20% or higher growth. And certainly know a lot of people that worked at Stryker during that time, some of the people that are here. And it's very reminiscent of that story back then, which was focus on execution, focus on investment, focus on process improvement, really a strong focus on growth, which is a fun thing to be a part of. You know, high pressure environment as well. Obviously, when you're doing those level of investments and you're trying to grow share in a highly competitive market, you know, it comes with challenges, but also it comes with a ton of opportunity. And it's fun, you know.
How does being nimble help in the orthopedics? I guess I see the orthopedics as a kind of a World War I trench warfare kind of slog where you're fighting for inches of territory back and forth, two big armies going at it. And then you got a Novus in there with your strike team. You know, how do you function in an industry like that? And how does nimbleness help?
Yeah, I think scrappiness or nimbleness might be determined as the same thing, right? Okay. And so I think nimbleness and scrappiness is another way of saying how can you be disruptive? When I look at nimbleness, I look at how quickly from a strategy perspective can we shift direction or run to an investment? I know, you know, working for a larger company, you know, there's a couple different layers that you usually have to go through in terms of a process or innovation. You know, being nimble allows us to say, hey, we own our strategy outright. We own, you know, our P&L and we own our execution. And certainly we have shareholders that we, you know, are driving value for, and we got a team that we report to. But when I talk about nimbleness, it's, you know, doing 6 acquisitions in 3 years. It's, you know, developing a strategy around that. It's looking at the market as a whole and saying, hey, what can be disruptive in that space, either from an implant technology design, from a materials perspective, or from an instrument design, or what's an emerging technology that comes into play that you can go after. And so it allows you to, and our process allows for us to make sure that we're very aware of the market and we have a very clear defined strategy. And we do this annually. And that strategy drives product development over the next 3 years, but it also allows us to say, hey, is that theory or is that thing that we're vetting out actually make sense? Or do we need to shift directions based off of, you know, the aggressiveness of the foot and ankle market, which it's convoluted. There's a ton of players in it. It's a very high population in terms of surgeons. You know, technology has always been ever changing. And so you have to be nimble in this business to be able to shift gears and change, especially with the amount of innovation that's happening speed wise.
Right. You don't find success sending waves after waves of sales folks to take a few inches. Let's talk about foot and ankle, because while my World War analogy, I think it probably is better for like large joint, foot and ankle is very much more of a, I think, a street fight.
Yeah, it's
a new territory. So, all right, we'll take another quick break from our conversation to bring back our sponsor, Resonetics. Happy to have back with us Andy Pagana. He's the Director of Strategic Projects at Resonetics. He's part of Lightspeed. Andy, I haven't really heard about Nitinol before, or at least not outside of this job. I've heard of it before, but I've recently really come to appreciate the large role that it has in medical devices. So just tell us about some of the about the special qualities of Nitinol and why is it so important? Why is it so important in the topic we're talking about today, which is extremity applications?
So 99% of the medical device applications use the unique property of Nitinol called superelasticity. So what this is it allows you to achieve really high strains with constant force. So it's different than a conventional elastic plastic material where those strains are much lower and actually not recoverable. So for a suture passing application, for example, you know, you want to follow a tortuous path, but you also want that device to spring back to its original shape afterward, right? For an implant, like a bone staple, you want to apply constant compression on the joint to allow it to heal faster, right? For bones to heal, they actually need compression. So that superelastic property allows us to insert that bone staple in by straining it and apply that constant force on that joint we're trying to fuse.
And finally, Andy, what are some of the unique design and manufacturing challenges associated with Nitinol?
Sure. I think number one is just understanding the super elastic properties, right? And how to achieve them, right? To get that performance in the device that you need. You know, comes along with that is heat treatments, right? To get those unique properties, you really need to understand the metallurgy and that link to the performance. Surface finishing is also very important. And you need these devices to be biocompatible, right? So we've actually developed a lot of standard process flows over the years, and they've been optimized and proven again and again in order to help our customers get the ideal performance in their device. So we really are the leaders in the nitinol industry, and our goal is really to help our customers get their next generation nitinol devices to the market faster.
All right, really cool stuff. Once again, I'd love to learn about new things like nitinol. I'm happy to hear from you, Andy, on this, and we'll have Resonetics again at a Device Talks Tuesday a little later in June to learn more about nitinol. And of course, we're going to talk with Gary Justek at Innovus about their nitinol applications also a little later in this interview. So lots of great topics to be discussed. Lots of great insights from you, Andy. Thank you for joining us. And thanks, of course, to Resonetics for sponsoring this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. I implore you to be part of our Device Talks Tuesdays in a couple of weeks. If you want to find out more about Resonetics right now, and you probably should, go to resonetics.com. That's definitely should. Go to resonetics.com, resonetics.com. Talk to me about foot and ankle, because it's so, you say foot and ankle and you're like, oh, what do they got? Like one ankle and like a screw. It's like, I looked at your website, you have like 3 dozen different products that you're selling. So talk about the foot and ankle market.
Yeah. So what I learned from my time at Stryker was you can create a rapid growth business through focus, right? And I spent time doing that in trauma, and I did that in foot and ankle, and you learn to love foot and ankle. Most of my 19 year career has been in extremities and foot and ankle with a dash of trauma. And what's great about foot and ankle is it is rapid growth because of the 28 bones in the foot, the multiple ligaments and joints. And there's opportunity, you know, because up until about 5 years ago, there really wasn't much innovation. You had kind of Wright Medical as your main market share player, and they were driving a comprehensive portfolio for the foot and ankle surgeon versus using, you know, trauma applicated products and trying to make it work for foot and ankle. So when companies started to say, hey, here's this market and we can create a dedicated line and a series of implants, that's kind of what shifted the market. And that's when everybody started to enter it. We didn't exist on the scene at all in foot and ankle until about 3.5 years ago. And so we put together a business plan that said, hey, fastest growing market. You know, when you look at kind of the top, it's populated. You got Stryker, right, who's number one, probably Arthrex, that's number two. And then you kind of had this myriad of companies that were kind of spread out. And some were either very broad-based in terms of their portfolio offering, and some of them were very focused on a specific indication like total ankle. And there was a series between non-differentiated products and highly differentiated products. And so when we started to put the plans together, we said, well, if we're going to be aggressive in growing the space, we need to continue to look at how differentiated technology can drive improvements and outcomes in foot and ankle. So we got a little aggressive. When I say a little aggressive, we in the first year, we made 4 acquisitions. We got Star. Star Ankle was a divestiture from Stryker, the Stryker-Wright merger. We picked up Star. And if you speak about differentiation, it is one of the only mobile bearing devices on the market. Now, with that comes its own challenges of working through. It's a class 3 device. And so you saw all these entrants in terms of, you know, class 2 devices that have entered the market. And what we believe in is the long-term data is, it's one of the best ankles on the market in terms of long-term survivorship. And so how can you innovate into that space, which total ankle is one of the fastest growing segments of foot and ankle at roughly 10% a year. Still a smaller segment. And when you look at the 2.8 billion in foot and ankle, total ankle is only about 200 million of it, but certainly growing, you know, because of all of the entrants in the space. But then we bought Trilliant Surgical, which was a little $22 million company based out of Houston, Texas. What made them unique is they had some really good IP around cannulated screws and lock plating, which is essentially bread and butter in foot and ankle fixation. Hmm. And the other thing that was really, really unique, which is important for our story, is they own their own manufacturing facility, which most $20 million companies don't own manufacturing. No. And they did it, and you go back to the word scrappy, they were a scrappy machine shop in Houston, but they own their own destiny, where there's a lot of companies that you'll see even in foot and ankle, given the comprehensive portfolio, supply chain's a challenge. So you can't rapidly innovate and you cannot own your own destiny unless you have some handle on manufacturing and rapid prototyping that allows you to innovate. So, you know, yes, we got a really robust core plating system and screws and some other things to round out our portfolio. But what we really got was a manufacturing facility that could give us the ability to be aggressive. Hmm. And then the one that kind of turned everybody's heads in May of 2021 was MedShape. And MedShape is highly differentiated technology using a nitinol and shape alloy in foot and ankle applications. Their flagship product was the DynaNail. The DynaNail has now been on the market for 10 years. It had something like 13% better outcomes versus standard TTC fusion. So looking at implant design to say, post-application, how do you still provide compression? And compression provides better healing and lower non-union or lower failure rates. And so we did that. And then we acquired some IP in June of 2021 that allows us to go essentially have a product for Lapidus, which is the other fastest growing segment, bunions. You hear a lot about Treace and all these other companies that are entering the space. And so four acquisitions in roughly 7 months. And then we decided to take a break.
How many people came with those acquisitions? How much of what you're doing is sort of incorporating new people into a culture, or how much was just a product acquisition?
It's a great question, right? So, you know, two of those companies were large companies, larger companies, meaning were over 20 million in revenue, had their own infrastructure in terms of supply chain operation, had their own commercial selling teams. The other two were pretty much product bolt-ons. You know, for Star, we had to start from scratch because it was the only thing that came over it was a clinical support team. So when we originally started, we were roughly around 120 employees, but we had to build the culture from the ground. And the culture sometimes led by the businesses that you acquire, you know, but what we said is we need to create a culture that is different unto itself in foot and ankle. And the culture is focused on how do you develop, aggressively innovate, or if you can't innovate, acquire differentiated technology in the space to improve outcomes. And I know a lot of companies say that, and certainly that exists, but how do you also do it in a startup mentality where if you want to build something great, come here. This is a destination that we've created to say, we don't have all the answers right now. Certainly we've been aggressive in acquiring, you know, something like 51% of orthopedic acquisitions fail. How are we going to do this differently? And we're going to focus on the end in mind, which is we're going to look at all the segments in foot and ankle and say, hey, what are the ones that have the lowest union rates or have high complication rates? And how can improvements in either implant technology or instrumentation allow us to create something that's different? And then naturally on the commercial side, because when you do that many acquisitions, I think at one point we had 257 agents. Wow. And all of these agents carried something that was competitive to something else we acquired. So how do you create dedication over time? Well, you got to create a story and you got to create brand loyalty and you got to create that destination that says to a sales agent or a direct rep, hey, that's something that I want to be a part of and that's something that I think I can grow. That's an important piece of what we really focused on after that first initial round of acquisitions. People underestimate you had four ERPs, you had four inventory management systems. And we focused on just building the core, building out marketing teams, building out a really robust product development team, and really just focused on that. And during that time, we've had 8 product launches. So yes, we've been aggressive in acquisitions, but we also have been aggressively innovating, you know, some of the IP and technology that we acquired from these acquisitions. And then just a glutton for punishment, we decided to round it out with 2 more acquisitions here. In July of 2023, acquiring the assets from Seal, which is a really great innovative X-Fix system that fits well within our portfolio. And then Novastep, which is really our way to aggressively get into the MIS space, which is an emerging, everything that's old is new. It used to be really popular in the 80s, but certainly the ancillary benefits of doing minimally invasive surgery for foot and ankle patients, that coupled with some really great implant technology can really give you a strong position in the space long term.
I want to delve a little more into foot and ankle in a moment, but just as you're building this company, I'm curious, how long are you interviewing people for when you're bringing them aboard? Is it a 6-month interview or is it?
No. I mean, the reality, there's a different type of pedigree that we look at when we build this business. And what I tell the teams is just because somebody has a resume and they've worked for one of the big 4 or big 5 doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be successful in this environment. And I say that because the mentality here is completely different, meaning you have to be a part of problem solving and you have to be more entrepreneurial minded. All the answers aren't given to you. And so, you know, when you're integrating at that pace, you need people that can, you know, see the field and play or the play develop in front of them and say, okay, you know, we're going to try something and this might not work, but we're not going to be afraid to fail, but fail fast and make improvements. And so I have a saying, it's, you know, hire fast, fire faster, and promote the fastest. And so, and that's not, you know, that's something that is widely known in orthopedics. And so we look for strong talent, entrepreneurial-minded individuals and people that want to be a part of building something. And that's attractive right now in foot and ankle because there have been some larger mergers like Stryker, right? You know, companies are continuing to get bigger. And what we've always tried to say is let's maintain a flat organization. We don't need to, you know, in order to stay nimble, which is at the core of what we do, let's make sure that we continue to create an environment where we can redefine foot and ankle. You know, better is to us is it's creating a more nimble organization that no matter how large we get, we continue to keep that startup mentality and feel because frankly, we've been successful with that and you can't turn your head on what got you to where you are.
Going back to foot and ankle, talk about the customers. Are there surgeons who are performing foot and ankle procedures, total ankle replacement? Are they the same women and men who are replacing knees and hips, or are they a certain artisan? Because it seems like a different procedure. Less carpentry, more table building, I don't know, chair building or something like
that. It's a little bit of carpentry. It's a little bit of arthroscopy background. You know, what's unique, and I think why a lot of companies have ran to it is, yes, it's the fast growing segment in dedicated foot and ankle, but it also has probably one of the largest subsets of very specifically trained foot and ankle customers and surgeons that are different. So you'll always have your mix of your general surgeon and geographies that does a little bit of everything. But our main customer is your fellowship trained orthopedic MD, fellowship trained in foot and ankle, and then surgical podiatrists. You know, surgical podiatrists, you know, make up probably, you know, 6,000 of the available customers or you're close to 7,000. And then roughly 3,500 is your orthopedic fellowship trained MDs. And, you know, the mix is, you know, really you have people that depending on market, because what's unique about foot and ankle specific as it relates to podiatry, it's market and state dependent, right? So there's certain restrictions and regulations in terms of where they can do surgery. And so having, you know, you have 4-foot specialists in foot and ankle, you have people that operate from the midfoot to the forefoot, and then you have people that kind of stem to stern do everything from ankle trauma to total ankle all the way through hammer toe. So it's a really, really unique market because if you look at just the customer subsets and the number of verticals within the space, as you say, it's a street fight, but at the same time, a really good opportunity from a company perspective to try to create differentiation and customer loyalty. You know, and it can be, you know, that changes that rapidly. I'd say that foot and ankle is probably a little bit like spine from that, where you saw a lot of people run to the space and that's what's created, you know, some competition or a little bit of that street fight. It has a little bit of the sentiments of spine from that perspective in terms of the technology and the number of players, but really good opportunity to drive something different, in my opinion.
So last question, just going forward, how do you build this business? And I guess I'm looking at Star. Is that the tree from which you hang all the other ornaments? Is that the thing that's driving this, or is it really all the smaller pieces that's going to be the larger part of your business going forward? And Star is sort of the high end, only a small percentage of people need that level of treatment.
You know, I'd say foot and ankle really has kind of two tips of the spear, right? Okay. So there used to be a saying that if you own the total ankle, you own the surgeon, right? Because the procedure was so complex that if you had the, you know, the relationship with that surgeon for a complex procedure like total ankle, then naturally it could open the door into all the other things that that surgeon does. A little bit of the saying is the same for bunions and forefoot, right? Just because of the amount of procedures being done. Here's some simple stats. You know, 1.3 billion of that 2.8 is everything from the midfoot to the toe. And the largest segment of that is bunions. And so, you know, although the total ankle is a complex procedure, you know, a very technical, it's still a growing and emerging technology in the space. Even though STAR has been on the market for over 20 years, its overall market share was relatively low just because, you know, people would do primary fusions and fusions were the way to treat ankle arthritis at the time. And there's been advancements over the past 8 years that have really done it. So for us, it's really kind of 4 main verticals from a product perspective. One is advanced recon. So probably our most differentiated portfolio really came on the heels of the MedShape acquisition. Mm-hmm. And that's where you have all your nitinol based implants that we're designing. And so within advanced recon, you have nails, external fixation, staples, and biologics. That's really for your complicated, you know, complex reconstruction cases. Those are your diabetic Charcot patients, your sick patients that really need, an implant that can help to apply compression so you don't have failure. And that is a cornerstone for us. It's probably, it represents 40% of our total portfolio. It also represents, you know, the highest amount of growth, because what we're doing is taking that technology that exists for 10 years and putting into smaller applications so you can go do midfoot fusions, so you can go do subtalar fusions, that you could take that technology and advance it. The second kind of vertical for us is core, because if you want to be taken seriously from a foot and ankle perspective, you have to have, you know, anatomic specific plates, you have to have cannulated screws, and really that's a majority of kind of where your procedures sit. And the advancements in that has been, you know, really creating instrumentation to help make complicated procedures more repeatable for the surgeon, right? So an extra set of hands per se. And that's where I don't think plate and screw design has changed dramatically over the past 3 to 4 years. But what I think has happened is you're starting to see enabling technology and instrumentation really start to open avenues and make procedures more repeatable, and hopefully outcomes more repeatable in terms of that. The third vertical is really MIS. And so when we acquired Novastep, MIS is very heavy in bunion, because it, again, go back to, it's the largest segment. And certainly patients that get bunion, either because of pain or for cosmetic reasons, want a quicker return to function. And so doing it with smaller incisions, you know, has a lot of benefits to the patient in terms of recovery. But it's not just in bunion. We bought actually Novastep to be a platform for MIS into other aspects of foot and ankle. Talk about ankle fusion, talk about Charcot foot reconstruction. If you can do that from an MIS perspective, you're actually advancing a foot and ankle from the perspective of healing and outcomes. And then, yes, total ankle, it is a big segment. You know, Stryker Wright has a pretty dominant market share as it sits, just because of the comprehensiveness of their portfolio. But we bought STAR to be a workhorse for us. Really, there is a group of customers that have been very loyal to the mobile bearing technology. We've been willing to put our money where our mouth is in terms of investing into that, even though there's quicker pathways to a two-piece ankle through a 510K approval. We've recently got our second approval on STAR, which is our vitamin E poly. We're going to be commercializing that here in Q2. We did come out with PSI on STAR. And again, making, you know, a 20-year-old ankle, how do you do it to compete with today's market, which is, you know, faster procedures, better instrumentation, better implant design? But we're not stopping at STAR. Certainly, you know, Stryker Wright has proved that there's a market for revision, and there's not a lot of implant options out there for revision. So we've been innovating to add to our portfolio for total ankle. So STAR certainly is a cornerstone in terms of total ankle for us, but, you know, it won't be the only thing that we work to develop to advance total ankle technology over time.
Well, with STAR, I see you've got a note on your website about if you had a STAR implanted prior to August 1st, 2014, click here.
Yeah.
For, what is that directed to? Is that
So when we, shortly after acquired STAR, the FDA did send a warning letter to Stryker at the time, because they were the manufacturer of record, regarding the polyethylene as it relates to STAR. And so what Stryker did, rightfully so, is standard poly has a tendency to oxidize. And Stryker put it in a foil pack, which, you know, resists the on-shelf oxidation that happens when an implant sitting, you know, after it was manufactured and sterilized. A lot of what they did prevented additional oxidation, but we've been spending really the past 3 years working with the FDA to prove that the issue with the STAR initially, or their perception to give a warning letter, was on the material itself and not necessarily on the design. And so we've worked really hard to do benchtop testing to simulate the same type of fracture that these aged polys would see very early on prior to putting in a foil pack. And we've worked with the FDA. That's why it took us, you know, essentially 460 days to work through the approval, because we did a lot of benchtop testing to prove that vitamin E is a better material for polys. And because it's infused, it actually resists oxidation. And if it resists oxidation, the probability of a fracture decreases significantly as part of that. So a lot of what we've been doing to innovate STAR has to do in response to that warning letter that we got shortly after the acquisition back in 2021. But it's also an important thing that we wanted to do for the future of STAR as well.
Final question. I know I've said that about 10 minutes ago. You mentioned Nitinol a few times. So is that part of the bunion product portfolio? And how does, I mean, it's a novel technology, novel material that we're seeing everywhere. How does that fit into the foot?
So Nitinol, it's been around for a long time, obviously. Yeah. It sits in other orthopedic implants. But Nitinol, in its current form, you know, MedShape had a lot of IP around using Nitinol in implants. And so it's a simple concept on if you can have a static nail, but you stretch a nitinol insert in between those two nail bodies and you can get that device to slide and you span a joint and provide compression when you're trying to get fusion and healing, then the ancillary benefit is it's going to drive and generate more bone healing because you have bone-on-bone apposition and contact. And so that was the original theory for a DynaNail. So a TTC fusion, which that's when you fuse both joints of your ankle, the published, you know, union rate was somewhere in the 70s. And what DynaNail proved is by providing apposition and compression postoperatively, you know, across these segments or joints, then you can see increases in union rates. And so that existed, but MedShape also had some really great IP around nitinol staples. They're everywhere, right? Everywhere from in foot and ankle, starting to get into spine. And so what we did is uniquely different. You know, the IP that we have is the compression is in the bridge versus the legs. So what that allows you to do is to create unique implant designs and staples that can treat things that have traditionally been treated by plates and screws. And the challenge with plates and screws is it's a static construct. It's usually locked into place. And so if you don't get good bone-on-bone apposition during joint prep, you have a higher opportunity, and I wouldn't say opportunity, a higher prevalence of non-union because of that. And so what we've done is designed staples that, you know, mimic plate and screws that also provide high strength of compression. And there's some research we're doing around those versus kind of the gold standard in plate and screw fixation that allow you to do something uniquely different. So right now, most of our nitinol technology sits in infusion. So, you know, things like Charcot foot reconstruction, subtalar fusion, TTC fusions, and also with the staple designs, all of your midfoot fusions and hindfoot fusions, you know, MTP fusions, TN and CC fusions, it covers a wide variety. And, you know, what we're working on is even taking that DynaNail technology to the next level and making even smaller sizes so that you can create essentially a dynamic or active adaptive implant, even in smaller sizes, to be able to go up a traditional screw fixation.
Wow. Like I said, I thought foot and ankle was a sleepy little neighborhood, but you guys got a lot going on.
I think some of the best innovation we're seeing in orthopedics right now is in foot and ankle. Things like 3D printing, yep. You know, what Lima does for us in the acquisition, you know, Lima's obviously very heavy in creating surgical as a true global player. But what sits behind the scenes there is a really great 3D printing technology, and 3D printing is prevalent in foot and ankle right now, either for PSI guided instruments or even wedges or cages to help with certain foot reconstruction. So looking at scratching the surface in terms of the partnership with Lima, you know, there's other ancillary technologies. You take some of the things that surgical's working on around augmented reality. And if you could just test this notion of, okay, it creates a more repeatable procedure for the masses. And if you're looking at foot and ankle, small, obviously, you're not wide open incision, you're doing minimal incision. If you could start to look at, you know, taking and carrying some of that technology over into midfoot or bunion reconstruction, then you're really scratching the surface on what can be possible in foot and ankle. You know, I don't see big robotics like, you know, we saw in, you know, total joint recon, but I do see some pretty innovative things happening in the space over the next 3 to 5 years.
Very cool. All right. Well, great stuff. Gary, thanks for joining us, for being on the podcast, and good luck with the Cubs this year. I hope they...
Yeah, best of luck to the Sox. Hopefully you're not tortured. Hopefully we both enjoy the fruits of a successful season in both Boston and Chicago.
From your lips. Take care, man.
Thank you.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. If you haven't already subscribed to the Device Talks Podcast Network, please do. We've got lots of great podcasts coming your way, including Abbott Talks. We're working on some new Intuitive Talks. We've got a big Stryker Talks I'm recording this month. I'll share more details when the recording is done. And, of course, we've got all these great Device Talks Weeklies, Device Talks AI, and more Device Talks podcasts that we're working on and that you will want to hear. So, again, subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network on any major podcast player so you don't miss a future episode. Again, go to devicetalks.com to check out our upcoming roster of Device Talks Tuesdays episodes. And thanks again to Resonetics for sponsoring this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Make sure you please connect with us on LinkedIn. Connect with me, Tom Salemi. I'm editorial director of Device Talks. Connect with Chris Newmarker, executive editor of Mass Device. and connect with our managing editor, Kayleen Brown, on LinkedIn. If you haven't already connected with me or followed me, I prefer the connection, but follow if you'd like. You're missing out on some great material that we're sharing from not only from Device Talks, but from our MDO and our Mass Device publications. So if you want to keep abreast, keep ahead of what's happening in the medtech world, make sure you connect with us or follow us on LinkedIn. And that's it, folks. Thanks again for tuning into this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. We'll have another episode coming to you next week. Take care, everybody.